Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Hello and welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from blind archer Janice Wolf. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with blind archery.
Well, I got started in it back in 2004 because my husband, who is sighted, he had taken up the sport and he was enjoying it with friends, and he joined a club, and so I was going with him to club events, and he started competing locally, and so I would go with him, and then I started to think, I wonder what I'd kind of like to experience what it feels like to shoot a bow and have the arrow leave the bow and hit the target, and what's that experience like. And so I did some internet searches to see if there were any blind archers out there who had a technique for sighting, if you can't see to sight. And there wasn't much out there back then, but I found British Blind Sports was doing it, and they had developed a technique for aiming, for sighting, and it was a technique that was approved, sanctioned by the International Blind Sports Association. So they sent pictures of the setup through email to us, and my husband built the equipment for me, and I started shooting, and I joined the club, and So I enjoyed it, and it was a good technique. And I decided that since my husband was enjoying it so much, that I wanted to see if maybe I could attend the local competitions as well and give that a try, even though I didn't have anybody to shoot against per se. But I asked them, you know, would you let me participate in the tournament? And they said, yes, you could be a guest. There is no category for visually impaired right now. So that's kind of how I got started in it back in 2004. And it kind of gradually led to first here in California, them accepting it later that, like in June of 2004, as an official category for California. And then when we decided we wanted to try shooting at the U.S. Nationals, inquired to them whether they would let me shoot at the U.S. Nationals, since there wasn't a category. And they said, yes, that I could, and they created a category, visually impaired, for U.S. Nationals, and I was the first blind archer to shoot at U.S. Nationals as well. So it kind of just snowballed, I guess you would say, to then being invited by the para coach of our para archery team to participate in the World Championships in 2007, which was the first time visually impaired archers were going to be included in the Paralympic World Championships.
So
I did that in 2007.
So
did I answer your question, or did I go off topic?
No, you absolutely did. But for those who wouldn't be as familiar with some of the modified equipment used for blind archery, would you mind describing some of what makes it possible for you?
Yes. So this technique is used for target archery, okay? Because in target archery, which is what is shot in Paralympics and Olympics, and the shooting line is a fixed shooting line, and you're shooting at an archery range, which is usually a big field or a big, if it's indoor, it's a big auditorium type situation. And so the shooting line is fixed, and the targets are out in the field arranged at different distances. And for visually impaired, we shoot as far as 30 meters. That's the furthest we shoot officially. And they've determined that that's a reasonable distance so that you are hitting the target, being able to score your arrows and not missing the target altogether hitting in the grass a lot. That's reasonable for visually impaired. So the equipment is kind of two parts. And it's the first part is called a foot locator, and the foot locator is a piece of, let's just call it, for because they're made out of different materials. There is really no company that makes these. Each person builds their own equipment. So I'm just going to say a board or a piece of metal. Okay, mine is aluminum. Mine is actually made out of a drywall square. That's the basis of it. But so it's not very wide. And it lays across the shooting line so that the archer is straddling the shooting line. So when the proper positioning for shooting archery for anybody is to straddle the shooting line, and you're facing down the shooting line. And if you're a right-handed shooter, the targets are all to your left. Okay, so this foot locator goes across the shooting line so that you can back your heels up against it and know that you are standing in the same place and positioned properly. There's what I call foot markers that come out from that foot locator that your feet can go alongside. Very simple, nothing major, but they stick out so that you can line up your feet alongside them so that you know you're aiming your feet in the right direction every time. A sighted archer can look down at the ground and look at their feet and say, yeah, that's where I was standing last time. This is a good position. Well, if you can't see, you don't know that, so you need an indication down on the ground so that you're always returning to the same location on the shooting line. And then there's a tripod type device. It doesn't have to be a tripod. Mine is. A lot of them are, but it's a tripod type device that is attached to that foot locator on the left side of it. That on top of that tripod device is where your sighting device is mounted. So a sighted archer has a bow sight that they attach to their bow, and when they're at full draw, they're looking through that sight to aim at the target. That's how they line up with the target. So since I can't see to line up a sight visually on the target, my sight is mounted on this tripod, and a piece that projects out from the sight is what I use to aim by drawing back my bow like anybody else does. But the hand that is gripping the bow, I use the back of my hand then touches this sighting piece that is sticking out from my sight that's on the top of that tripod. So now I know that I have the right elevation and that I'm aiming towards the target. And now I have to perform my shot like any other archer has to. You need to be consistent. You need to learn the proper technique. Your anchor points need to be consistent. Use the right muscles. You have the right pace, And it's now you can shoot, and your arrows, if you have a good shot, your arrows will go where they need to. If you have a bad shot, then they won't. And so it's very low-tech, no bells and whistles. You don't need electronics. You don't need sound. one of the biggest reasons not to use electronics for aiming or sound, and I know they use that in biathlon, for blind biathlon, they do use audio cues for shooting. But it's not used for archery. One of the biggest downfalls of this technology is it's going to fail you when you need it the most, and it's really not necessary for archery, and so you don't need that added complication. But by having in competition, I use the same bow sight that a sighted person would mount on their bow. I use that same bow sight, but it's mounted on my tripod. So the advantage is that you can raise and lower it as you need, or adjust right to left right there on the bow sight. So when I'm shooting and my caller is saying, you know, they will call where my arrows are landing, depending on the color of the ring and the clock face. So let's say the inside ring is yellow, and then there's a red ring, a blue ring, a black ring, and a white ring. And so if I'm shooting and I'm shooting like a red 9 o'clock, and then I shoot a blue 7 o'clock, well, okay, I seem to be on the left-hand side of my target. So now I can just reach over myself and turn that sight, the adjustment on the sight, turn it to the right a little bit, and then go back to shooting. And so once your sighted person that is assisting you gets you lined up to the target, your equipment lined up, and so then we stake it down so it won't move on you, you can be very independent in how you decide your equipment needs to be adjusted, and what you need to do, you know, to do that shot.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
In this next segment of our show, we'll hear a little bit about wheelchair boxing from Sean Morris. So tell me a little bit about wheelchair boxing.
Wheelchair boxing is a sport that most people don't know even exists. It's an inclusive, adaptive sport that people with cerebral palsy or disabled people in a typical boxing scenario now have an opportunity to match each other in terms of size, strength, and skill. And it's a box.
So how is it modified to make it possible for someone in a wheelchair?
Sorry, Cam, can you repeat that question?
Certainly. How do they modify the sport to make it possible?
Well, first and foremost, boxing requires stringent medicals to be done and passed by potential boxers before competing. Now, people who are disabled or can't box standing up are offered an opportunity to go through the same process and to be sanctioned as well as a competitive boxer.
So are there any challenges in putting the sport together?
The challenges in putting the sport together, first and foremost, I think would be finding the athletes who are interested in doing it. And second of all, having the support and the structure in place to accommodate those new athletes in a growing sport. Finding the right venue, for example, you know, that will have the necessary insurance for, you know, boxing or wheelchair boxing. And there are lots of elements that are involved, and it's difficult to, I guess, start the sport up. It's already prevalent in the UK, in France, and there are, I think, 34 countries around the world now that have wheelchair boxing. But Canada is just beginning to open the door to that process. And Charles Wilton, who I've been working with, is really a kind of a forerunner for bringing the sport to life in Canada.
And what sorts of successes have you and Charles seen regards to this?
What sort of which, sorry?
What sort of successes have the two of you seen so far?
We've seen a growing interest in people for what Charles is doing in terms of boxing and taking a stand to do the impossible. We've had, you know, a filmmaker be attracted to Charles and what's happening with wheelchair boxing and take that documentary project on and work with the CBC to bring that to fruition. We've had a number of sponsorships, and I think that's a key thing, is just finding the right funding to be able to make these events happen.
So what are the next steps going forward?
The next steps going forward, right now we're creating an organization called the Canadian Wheelchair Boxing Association, which is essentially looking at a practical, safe, healthy arena in which to invite new potential wheelchair boxers all over Canada, starting with mainly Ontario. The next step is probably to have some events and to have some safe boxing events that get sanctioned properly. And just keep moving forward and to grow awareness of the sport and be able to set up new events and venues across Canada for people that want to come out and be a part of this lifestyle.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure, thank you.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Whether you're hosting friends for a night in, exploring new restaurants and breweries in town, or going out to your favorite watering hole, please drink responsibly. Designate a sober driver, call a taxi, a friend, or just stay over. Thank you for always driving sober. A message from Arrive Alive, Drive Sober.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from blind archer Janice Wolf and from Sean Morris, who told us a little bit about wheelchair boxing. In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Ania Jones from the Schizophrenia Society. So tell me a little bit about the Schizophrenia Society.
So the Schizophrenia Society of Ontario has been around since 1979, supporting people, communities, and families who are impacted by schizophrenia and psychosis. We were started by two caregivers in 1979 who did not think that support was adequate in their own Oakville community for their son living with the condition. And so they started the society in 1979 as a small support group. And since then, we have grown to be supporting thousands of Ontarians. We have four offices across Ontario, lots of staff and volunteers, lots of community groups that we run across communities in Ontario. So we just have come a long way since our humble beginnings in 1979.
So what sorts of programs and services do you offer today?
So the most important service that we have for people in Ontario and really anywhere in Canada as well, we have an Ask the Expert counseling support helpline. Sorry, can I say that again?
Sure. Whenever you're ready.
So really our most important service is, and the first point of contact that we have for people across Ontario is our counseling helpline. and it is called Ask the Expert. And what it does is it provides support for people and families affected by schizophrenia or psychosis. So not only individuals, but also parents, caregivers, and family members. And it is an online email and phone service. And as well, we have a drop-in counseling service as well. And so what you can do through Ask the Expert is just get connected immediately to a counselor and get the support that you need and get information about some of the services in your own community that you can access. So that's one thing. It's really the first point of contact for people, no matter where they are in the province, to be able to get that specific support. Some of the other things that we offer are community groups, so family support groups, psychoeducation groups in the community where people can go meet with other caregivers, as well as staff who are leading the groups and just get the support that way in their own communities. And as well as that, we offer advocacy. So what we do as an organization is that we advocate a lot for health system changes or quality of care that's being received, whether it's in the hospital or community. And the other thing that we do really, really well is we have a justice and mental health program. And that's a program that really helps people be treated fairly within the correction system. So if there's an interaction with officers of the law, we provide support and education both to police, but also families and caregivers in that respect as well.
So are there any challenges in providing these services? I particularly imagine in the corrections case, this isn't always an easy task.
So I think the challenges that we address as an organization and even society as a whole is that the symptoms of schizophrenia can be confusing to those who are experiencing it and also those who are caring for them or people that meet someone with the illness when, of course, the illness is presenting symptoms, because one of the things that I've learned even about the illness myself working for the society is that people can and do live fulfilling lives, and you truly often wouldn't know that they have the illness when symptoms are not presenting. So I certainly meet people every day who are successful, well-spoken, have a full life. However, when you are symptomatic, the symptoms can be difficult. So what generally it is a break from reality, so hallucinations, delusions, difficulty organizing speech. Some people can experience being paranoid. And so these symptoms can be confusing. The confusion is often a fear of opening up and talking about them, so which is why we have the Ask the Expert line. But these symptoms can definitely be well managed. And what we work against is really society's assumptions about what the illness is and the stigma. And that can make help getting help challenging. And so what we as an organization do is we address those challenges through awareness, education, and advocacy, but also the programs that we have on the ground. So like I mentioned, our phone helpline, the counseling helpline, but also the Justice and Mental Health Program. And so that's sort of where we step in, and we fill that critical gap in the community where we provide an education source and a source of awareness through the staff and volunteers that work with us. And we work with community organizations, and we work with families and caregivers as well as individuals.
So in terms of the justice and mental health, which I'm quite curious about, is there any success story that you can share about when you were able to provide correct information or get someone the appropriate sort of treatment they needed?
Okay, so for that particular question, I can put you in touch with somebody who can speak in particular to the Justice and Mental Health Program. We have a lead expert on that at the Society. I could do that if you would like. You can?
Well, in that case, is there any success story with the association in general that you can share?
Let me think of a good one. So I think what I do want to share is that May 24th is World Schizophrenia and Psychosis Awareness Day internationally, and that is dedicated to raising awareness for the cause and for the people and families that are impacted. So we're very excited about this day because it gives us the opportunity to raise awareness in communities, but also help people know who may not know about us, but they can come to us for support and to get help. And it's really, we've seen over the past number of years, we've seen a lot of the conversation be more open and people coming in, talking to us more and more about different issues that may not have been as easily talked about in the past. So we want to spread that message of hope even further. We want to spread that message of hope to people who are going through a difficult time, whether it's individuals, caregivers. We want to give them a reason to hope that things can get better, that they're not alone, and that we're here if they need support.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Excellent, sure.
In regards to the wheelchair boxing interview, let me make it clear that I myself, nobody at the station, is necessarily endorsing the sport of boxing. Whether you approve or you disapprove of the sport, I maintain it is a person with a disability's right and obligation even to be included in all facets of life, to have the freedom to make that choice, that we would create something to make it possible. That way the individual, they can decide for themselves if they want to be involved. I mean, the physical conditioning, the training, still a lot of strength goes into it. The fact of the matter is, it's not about whether a person chooses to express their means of sport one way or the other. It's about equal participation, equal involvement in the community and in society. A person with a disability should always have the freedom to make that choice, no matter what it is that makes them special. Whether they move a certain way, or think a certain way, or see a certain way, full participation means the right to choose, the right to have their wishes heard and respected, and yes, even acted upon. Creating something new for the disability community, that always has value, because it's broadening the tapestry of what they see as possible, what they understand can be open to them. I mean, some will say, I don't want to be involved in boxing. Some will say, it's not my thing. Some will say, yeah, absolutely, I want to learn how to do this. But what it comes down to, my friends, is giving them the option. A person with a disability's hopes and dreams, they're all their own. If you're someone with a story of disability life, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. Always love to hear your stories, folks. Fact is, what a person chooses to do in their story, what they choose to express themselves by doing, that's on them. But the validity of their right to choose and their right to be involved in society gives them that opportunity to say, I want to do this or I don't want to do this. We must continue to expand our definitions of what should be offered to whom. Rethink what's possible, my friends. Look at things from another angle. Won't work this way. What about that way? And how do we know it won't work until we try it? Do we just accept what people assume? Or do we try it for ourselves? This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.